Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, July 28th, welcome to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And my name is Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're so happy to have you here on this Monday, a new week of Studio 2.
Yes, and today we're going to be talking about higher education. The Trump administration has targeted top elite institutions like Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, Columbia, for being too woke. The administration has put a microscope on their DEI policies, alleged anti-Semitism on campus, and on policies around trans athletes in sports. The Trump administration has told the universities, change your policies immediately or lose your federal funding. Harvard chose to sue, but is under mounting pressure. Penn and Columbia recently caved under that pressure and chose to settle with the Trump administration to keep their funding flowing. And so today we'll ask whether the settlements are smart compromises or signs of surrender. And we'll look at how much control the federal government should have over college campuses. We have a legal expert, a university professor, and a conservative voice on the show to help us talk through it all. And our questions for you, our listeners at home, are this. What do you think about schools like Penn striking deals with the Trump administration? We'd love to hear your thoughts. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you watching on YouTube, hello. Put those comments in the live chat.
Yeah, if you work at Penn alum, what do you think about your school making that deal with the Trump administration? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, the email studio2@whyy.org.
Trio of news stories.
Trio of news stories. And hey, why don't we stay in the higher ed space?
Oh, yeah.
For this first story. New bill introduced in New Jersey would allow that state's high school students to get automatic admission to state colleges and universities if they meet certain minimum academic thresholds. This story comes via NJ.com. The bill was introduced by Gloucester County Democrat Cody Miller, and it's modeled after similar rules in places like Texas, where if you're in the top 10% of your graduating class and you live in Texas, you're a Texas resident, you get automatic admission to some state schools. The NJ proposal, very early stages, doesn't have firm details yet, but the idea is that students would automatically get into schools like Rutgers or Rowan or Montclair State, good schools, mm-hmm. if they do well enough in high school, maybe finish top 10%, 5%, whatever it ends up being. And this is being pitched as a way to reverse the brain drain in New Jersey, that is, to keep students who would have gone to school out of state, in state.
Yeah, what was so interesting to me about this, Avi, is that New Jersey loses about 30,000 students a year to other states. They choose, they high school grads, they choose to go out of state. And yeah. So they're trying to keep some of those people there. And that's according to the National Center for Education Statistics. But one of the critics of the bill asked what happens after students are automatically admitted, right? Because schools cost. And so a lot of students, I know I was like this, I went to the school that gave me the biggest financial aid package.
Yeah.
And so some have said, look, you know, New Jersey needs to make sure that there is some back end support for students if they are automatically admitted. I know Georgia has the Hope Scholarship Program that provides these robust scholarships and grants to students who are automatically admitted. It's not 100%, but you're kind of guaranteed at least some money. And people say, look, this is a first step, but there needs to be some cha-ching on the other side of that.
Well, the cha-ching runs both ways here, because if you're a school, like Rutgers or whatever, you get a lot of international students and students from out of state who pay often full freight.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a discount, there's a subsidy for in-state students. Now, they still pay plenty. But if you are, if a larger percentage of your incoming class is in-state versus out of state, that could affect your school's finances as well. So I'm guessing Rutgers would have questions about that. Mm-hmm. This is also seen as a way, by the way, to boost diversity because, you know, if you're the 10% across the state, it doesn't matter what school you go to. Mm-hmm. And I think there is some evidence out of Texas that it has indeed done that. So sort of geographic, racial diversity, income diversity, it can help boost that as well.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens with that bill. Second story today, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro recently appeared on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert just a few days after CBS announced that Colbert would be canceled in May of next year. It was a pretty robust conversation if you had a chance to look at it. Shapiro spent about 15 minutes speaking with Stephen Colbert about everything from the arson attack on the governor's mansion to how he first got into politics and, of course, his opposition to President Donald Trump. And during that conversation, Colbert pointed out that there are thousands of Pennsylvania voters who cast their ballots both for President Trump as well as for Governor Shapiro. They have this overlap of voters who liked both of them. And Shapiro claims, you know, that his focus has been on solving problems for Pennsylvanians, which he believes is different from the focus of the president. Take a listen to the governor talking about the promises that President Trump made when campaigning across Pennsylvania.
He talks a good game, and then when he gets to govern, he does the exact opposite. I was showing up in rural areas where Donald Trump was showing up, and he was pledging to not cut people off of Medicaid. And what's the first big thing he does? He goes and he cuts 310,000 Pennsylvanians off of Medicaid with this bill they just passed, including 154,000 in communities that voted for him.
Interesting. And he's taking major swipes in this conversation at President Trump, which many believe, you know, is an implication that he's gearing up for a 2028 run.
Well, he's got to win 2026 first.
Yes.
That's his next governor's race. And some news on that front. Stacey Garrity looks like she's going to run. She's the state treasurer. It looks like Doug Mastriano, mm-hmm. who he beat last time, is also going to run. That's the latest reporting. I think that would be a dream matchup for Shapiro. He crushed him last time. Mm-hmm. And we talk about those Trump-Shapiro voters. You do have to acknowledge the context of the races. Shapiro had name recognition and was just broadly more popular than Mastriano, who he ran against.
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
so sometimes that's just what it is, right? They're choosing between two. And they're like, well, I really don't like that guy. So, you know, sometimes you have to go take a step back and just analyze the politics of the whole situation. But clearly, yeah, he's charting a course
mm-hmm.
for higher office. I think everyone believes that. And there are actions that back that up.
Yeah. And I had to mention this whole Colbert thing because Colbert said in his commentary, you know, we have 10 months. And told Shapiro, you know, you're welcome to come back. So
Colbert has 10 months.
Yeah.
Until he takes the show to WHYY, of course.
Put that out there.
Story number three.
So
a new kind of grocery store is coming to Philadelphia. One where you don't even need to go through a checkout line. Wow. The store is called Amazon Fresh, opening August 14th in the Spring Garden section of Philadelphia. This is the sixth Amazon Fresh in our region. And here's what makes it distinct. If you're an Amazon Prime member, you walk into the store, you pick up a special type of cart that allows you to scan items as you go, and then you just walk out. You leave the store. No checkout line. And it's a step toward this vision that Amazon has of a frictionless shopping experience,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you just sort of grab what you need and you go.
Yeah. You know what? I've been to some of these little convenience stores where all you have to do is there's no person in there. All you have to do is go pick something up and it just automatically charges your card. And it kind of creeps me out. You know, I'm not even gonna lie. I'm a little creeped out by this. And we talked about this whole cashless society thing. But I don't know. I just feel like there's a lot of surveillance involved. There's a lot of tracking. You know, you're not using cash anymore.
Yeah.
People just can track you to whatever you buy. I don't like it. It just feels like something, I don't know, like very too futuristic for me.
Yeah, very sci-fi.
Yeah, super sci-fi. There it is.
I do think when people describe like frictionless experiences, what they're often describing is you don't have to interact with another human being, which, look, there can be conveniences to that.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you know, human interaction, not the worst thing in the world.
No.
Kind of the glue that keeps society together. So maybe think
Absolutely.
About that. I do think at some point we will boomerang back around. So maybe like shopping will become frictionless, but people are going to seek out experiences where they get a chance to talk to another human being, maybe even a stranger. It doesn't have to be friends and family all the time, right? And so I do think there's like a push and pull to this. I like humans.
Like, I kind of like humans.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
I like a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, most
not
of them.
All of them.
Yeah,
but
not all of them. By the way, Amazon does have this technology where you can just walk in and out that you were talking about
mm-hmm.
that they have in some locations. It sounds like this one in Philly is not going to be like quite that frictionless,
yeah.
but it's clearly it's on a continuum moving in that direction toward just like, a grocery store of no cashiers and very few employees.
Yeah, and the countdown is on. It opens in just a couple of weeks. I want to check it out, though.
I am curious.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, curiosity counts for a lot. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about higher education, specifically Penn and Columbia striking deals with the Trump administration to get their federal funding back. And what does that mean for the future of higher ed? We want your thoughts. Studio2@whyy.org. Get those emails in.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. This month, Penn and Columbia struck deals with the Trump administration to restore federal funding. Harvard, Brown, Cornell, and Princeton could be next. The mighty Ivy League, confronted with a direct challenge from the federal government, appears to be bending.
The rest of higher education is watching and waiting. Is this the beginning of a new era? One where the federal government can impose its political agenda on private universities? And will higher ed's perceived liberal lean begin to vanish? We've got a great panel this hour to discuss all of that and a whole lot more.
Let me introduce them for the first time. Will Creeley is the legal director for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, also known as FIRE. Will, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.
And Jessa Lingle is an associate professor at Penn and director of its program in gender, sexuality, and women's studies. Jessa, great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And for our listeners at home and elsewhere, we invite you to join the conversation. Our question of the day is this: what do you think about schools like Penn striking deals with the Trump administration? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop those comments in the live chat.
And the comments coming in fast and furious. Hal emails us, university students today are not taught how to think, but how to repeat the doctrines of the woke orthodoxy. Donald Trump's efforts regarding universities are moving in the right direction. Is that the case, Will? Moving in the right direction here? What was your reaction when you saw that Penn and Columbia struck these deals? They're different deals, obviously, but
they're different deals, general thoughts. But my general thoughts are it is a shameful capitulation that ends a process that looks mostly, to me, like a mob shakedown. It looks like extortion. Mm-hmm. It looks like they're making decisions based on partisan politics enforced from the top down. I'm old enough to remember when conservatives professed to believe in small government, that they would react in horror to an elected official telling private entities, private institutions, what they can and can't decide to do on their own. So I think it is shameful. I hope that Harvard University continues to fight. I worry about the future if the federal government gets to dictate terms of curriculum, of basic academic decision making.
And so I want you to talk about the legal, because you're a legal expert here, and I want you to talk about some of the legal, just sort of guidelines when it comes to First Amendment and this division between higher education mm-hmm. and government and sort of where the Trump administration stands when you talk about it legally.
I'm happy to do that. First of all, the First Amendment protects academic freedom. That's the right of universities, both public and private, to make decisions about academic matters without government interference. That's the point. We've set up a knowledge-generating machine. You let it run. You don't have politicians tamper with it so they can get their desired outcomes, but that's exactly what's happening now. So Harvard has brought a First Amendment suit. My organization, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, has filed an amicus brief. It's a friend of the court brief, making clear that for 70 plus years, the Supreme Court has recognized that academic freedom is what we call a special concern of the First Amendment. It means hands off government. And we're not seeing that today.
And my follow up to you is, does the Trump administration have some legal grounds? For example, there has been arguments by the Trump administration that universities like Harvard, like Columbia, did not address anti-Semitism on campus and it violated civil rights law. Would that open the door for them sort of, you know, pushing these universities to do better?
It's a great question, Cherry. The thing is, the federal law that governs universities' responses to anti-Semitism. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act also has implementing federal regulations that dictate what the federal government has to do in order to pull funding. The Trump administration followed none of those requirements. In other words, they skipped the federal law that empowers them to address anti-Semitism and instead just did this top-down mob extortion routine. Said, we're going to cancel federal funding first. We don't care what the law says. And unfortunately, the universities have folded.
Yvonne on YouTube says, shame on Penn. But Cecil comments saying that the universities like Penn are hoping Trump leaves soon. They're holding on to their dollars in the meantime. And there is a real decision to be made here, Jessa. In Penn's case, I think it was $175 million. Mm-hmm. Do you just risk that to make a point, to stand up for academic freedom, for independence of private universities? Or do you say, you know what? Let's keep our powder dry now and fight this down the road. You're someone that could have been impacted by Penn losing money. What do you make of that?
I think it's not about trying to make a point. I think it's about trying to stand up for core values. So the core values of our university have always been about turning young people into critical thinkers, making them better citizens of the world, giving them the tools to think critically about differences of opinion, about different viewpoints. And we can't do that if we're afraid that we no longer have control over what we teach in the classroom, the kind of conferences we run, the kind of speakers that we bring on campus. I think it's not about proving a point. I think it's about standing up for what universities are supposed to be doing and creating the kind of climate where people have the freedom to teach and students have the freedom to learn.
Yeah. If they come to you, though, and they say, look, professor, like, we're doing this because we've got money funding, you know, disease research. We've got money helping our hospitals run. I mean, this research supports a broad array of things. Your argument back to them is, okay, I understand that, but you have to be willing to sacrifice that right now?
I have two arguments. One, and they've made these arguments to me.
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm.
administrators have made these arguments.
Really?
And what I say,
face to face.
Yes. And what they say is, or what I say back is, I don't know why you're so certain that this will be the end of the line. Mm. It's very clear to me that our administrators at Penn believe, you know, we're just going to put our heads down, stay out of the limelight, you know, cross our fingers for the midterms, wait for someone else to come into office. That's, to me, I understand the pragmatics of that, but I don't really buy that argument. I don't think we've seen that play out at Columbia. And I also think that we are, in the meantime, sacrificing the very values that brought us all to this institution in the first place. So the other thing is we're putting a price tag not on, you know, we're putting a price tag on human dignity. You mm-hmm. know, with this Title IX decision, we've just said an entire class of people are second-class citizens at our university, our institution. That's counterintuitive to what everything our founder, Benjamin Franklin, would have wanted. And it's counterintuitive to what people and I thought we were doing as educators.
Yeah, and I want to read this comment from Ruth, who sent in an email, who says, I think that any institution of higher learning that makes a deal with this dishonest administration that cares nothing for those universities is just plain wrong and inexcusable. They are betraying their students, and those students pay a lot and deserve better. And I see, Will, you're nodding your head
right.
at Jess's comments, and you know, I want you to sort of react to what she's saying. And specifically, you know, I think about, you know, the chilling effect mm-hmm. that this happens, you know, that happens because of actions that the Trump administration has taken. Can you talk about that and sort of the ripple effect
sure.
of what the slippery slope?
Yeah, let's
that
talk about
it.
So, Laura,
yeah.
we love our slippery slopes, and we talk about them because they're real.
Yeah.
Just as the good professor says, once Penn makes a deal, once it fails to hold the line, it is taught that every student and every prospective student that when times are tough, you duck your head. Whatever peace Columbia thinks it has bought for $200 million, it will not last. That is a temporary accommodation at most. And you can't look at any of this in isolation. You've got students being snatched off the street outside of Boston, Romeza Ozturk, who was at Tufts, Mahmoud Khalil at Columbia. The chill is real. And if universities think that they can just whistle and twiddle their thumbs for the next couple of years and not stand up and fight, I don't know if the next couple of years will bear that out.
And Jessa, I wanted to ask you, like, what does it feel like on campus? I mean, I know that, are there rules in place or is there just this feeling?
There is such a feeling right now. So when I talk to administrators, they say the line in the sand that we're going to hold is curriculum. We're going to protect what you teach and what you research. And that's what they say. But in the meantime, they leave this vacuum of what about everything else? And so that vacuum starts to fill with a sense of paranoia and fear. So we have students changing dissertation topics, changing honors thesis topics. We have faculty who are especially adjunct faculty who don't have protections of tenure, changing their course titles, changing course descriptions, or opting not to teach at all in programs like the ones I run, gender studies, which have, you know, more of a target on their backs because of what we teach. We have trouble finding co-sponsors for events. So all of these things are coming in this area. The chill is already here. So you can say from on high, we're going to protect, you know, academic freedom. But if you don't back that up with action, and if you aren't willing to state publicly, this scholarship matters, these community matters, we're going to support you, we're going to stand up for what's right, then in the meantime, students become afraid. Staff become afraid, teachers become afraid, parents become afraid, and you don't have this vibrant conversation on campus about, you know, learning and about exploring and testing new ideas. Instead, you have this climate of paranoia and fear. I really feel like Penn is becoming unrecognizable to me. I've been there for 10 years.
You said people changing titles of courses, dissertation topics. I mean, I don't know if you can give examples, but can you give me a sense of what that actually means, like on the ground? Because I think all our listeners would want to know what's not being discussed right now in the classroom or what's not being mm-hmm. studied.
So the way it works is that students feel like if Penn isn't standing up for, you know, trans rights, if it's not standing up for its LGBT community, that must mean these things are dangerous. So maybe I don't want this honors thesis title on my resume when I'm applying for jobs. Maybe I'll be a more competitive job market candidate if I teach different classes.
Are there trigger words, though, that people are really like looking at right now?
So people are afraid of having words like pro-LGBT, trans, mm-hmm. gender-affirming care. You know, I've had colleagues whose grants were cut because they were studying things about, like, how to support mental health or physical health for LGBTQ folks. So all of the trigger words that were already leading to grants getting cut, you know, not just at the CDC, not just at the NSF, but also in more humanities programs like the NEH, all of those trigger words, they get cut from funding, and then that bleeds into classroom conversations mm. and the kinds of events that you run.
And I'm sorry, I should have clarified earlier, but Penn's, I guess, violation here, I mean, it's never been entirely clear because this has mostly been going on behind the scenes, but the perceived violation here is that they allowed Leah Thomas to swim on the women's swim team a few years ago, I think 21, 22. So just want to clarify that because you were talking about all of those words. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to read this email from Vicky, who says, I am a Penn alumna who was on campus during the turmoil of the Vietnam War. It was a time of upheaval and protests. The pact Penn made with the Trump administration was appalling to me and fellow alumni. Since the university thinks only about money now and not academic freedom or diverse opinion, let them know I no longer support them. I have revised my will and rule. Remove them as a beneficiary. This is sort of the backlash that could be coming. I do want to sort of push back a little bit to you, Will, and to you, Jessa, because there's a data point that sort of stuck with me and doing this. In 1989, the liberal conservative faculty ratio was 2.3 to 1. In 2017, it had more than doubled to about 5 to 1. And some people have said, you know, look, universities have gotten a lot more liberal. There needed to be a reset. And this is the way the Trump administration is going about it. Is there a need for a reset?
Sure. I've defended free speech from students and faculty from across the political spectrum for damn near 20 years now. So I know that when I'm doing that work, most of the students and faculty I'm defending are conservative because they are outliers. They are dissidents on their campus. So I get that. But the ends to that means matter. You cannot have top-down control that violates both the First Amendment and federal law. If we want to encourage a diversity of viewpoints on campus, let the universities take the lead there. Encourage them to do so. Don't have it be done at the, you know, end of a metaphorical gun, right, with the threat of federal funding. Universities can get their house in order. Otherwise, you're just exchanging one orthodoxy for the other. And that's a real problem.
But, you know, but the Trump administration is saying, look, they did it. This was fast. This is swift. In months, it is done. What would the process actually look like if they were to do it the right way under federal law?
I'll tell you, Harvard gives us an example of that. Harvard in the last couple of years has opened what they call an Office of Intellectual Vitality. They've changed some of their admissions questions to ask students about when they were wrong about something, when they changed their mind, when they listened to a different viewpoint. You can select for faculty who are willing to challenge ideological groupthink, or you can select for students who are willing to listen to other opinions. You can encourage that through programming in the university. None of that requires violating the First Amendment. None of that requires an effective hostile federal takeover of our private universities.
I want to ask you, Professor, is there a liberal groupthink on campus? Is there a left lean? And does that, and I think beyond that, because we could quote those statistics that Cherry quoted about how the professors identify and the students identify, does that produce a certain type of thinking? Do students go out into the world thinking about the world a certain way because they've gone to Penn or to Yale or to Harvard?
I mean, I really wish that feminist theorists, queer theorists were as powerful and scary as people on the right seem to think we are. I mean, if we're so effective at changing minds and brainwashing people, why do we have the president we have? Like, this is kind of wild.
Who went to Penn, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Went to Wharton.
So, a key distinction. Okay.
Yes, there are a lot of liberal faculty. I don't know how much that matters if you're, you know, teaching chemistry. I mean, if you're teaching, so people don't actually care about political bias in the vast majority of fields. What they're really talking about is the rise in the last, say, 20, 30 years of programs like mine and gender studies, Africana studies. You know, that's what they're talking about. That's what conservatives are afraid of. And again, you're talking about very tiny programs that I really don't think have the sort of impact. But the broader point is, I'm happy to talk to people who are concerned about whether or not we're exposing students to the broad enough ideas, whether, you know, we're making sure that they hear lots of different voices in the classroom. This isn't the way to do it. This top-down cudgel, taking away funding, in some cases for things like, you know, cancer research or, you know, Alzheimer's research, all in the name of, you know, trying to deal with this, you know, woke thing that I frankly don't even really believe is there.
Well, yeah, that gets to my next question, which is, you said you're happy to have the conversation. Do you think at core, though, there could be a problem here, that there is something about, I don't know, the makeup of the faculty or the student body at these elite schools that just doesn't reflect broader American thought?
I truly believe that the reason you see an index of, you know, how educated you are and your, you know, a tendency to say, like, be liberal or identify as liberal is because liberal arts education, at the kind you're supposed to get at the University of Pennsylvania, exposes you to different viewpoints, expands your appreciation for diversity, expands your appreciation for tolerance. And that's what's at the root of liberal thinking, progressive thinking. So do I think that, in a way, yes, going to colleges like the University of Pennsylvania or any liberal arts school can make you more liberal? Yeah, because the path to getting there is reading lots of books, thinking critically, having exposure to a lot of viewpoints. I also want to say some of my favorite students in class are students who come from Wharton. As soon as I start talking about Marx, they're like, why would we, you know, calling on, like, we shouldn't be listening to Marx because communism failed in China. You know, they have very strong opinions. And I love those students because they make it so that other students feel free to challenge my ideas in mm-hmm. the classroom. So I think that the classrooms are more diverse than that argument believes. And I also believe in my core, it sounds probably a little naive, that part of the reason students come out believing in things like feminism and believing in things like diversity is because we're doing our jobs as a liberal arts educator.
Forcing people to think critically, yeah. Right? I want to invite you, our listeners at home and elsewhere, to join the conversation. Our question of the day is, what do you think about schools like Penn striking deals with the Trump administration? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop those comments in the chat. David on YouTube says, President Trump's use of federal funding as leverage amounts to federal overreach, undermining institutional autonomy and chilling dissenting to nonconforming ideas. Education deserves free speech. Will, I wanted to ask you about censorship because, you know, people who believe in the First Amendment hate censorship. They hate overreach by, you know, any government entity, whether it be the federal government or the state. There is no necessarily a court precedent here. But does this sort of cross into the censorship arena? And if nobody stands up to create a court precedent, what becomes of it?
Sure. I think it does, actually. And to Avi's good question a little while ago, what have we lost? Look at the state of Florida, where Governor Ron DeSantis passed what was called the Stop Woke Act. Mm-hmm. And that sought to remove 8, quote-unquote, divisive concepts from classrooms. So now you've got the state government putting a hand into college classrooms and saying, there are some things you can't talk about. Some of the things the professor was just mentioning now that she likes being challenged on. She likes the back and forth with students. You can't have those ideas. We are litigating against the Stop Woke Act. We're waiting for an opinion from the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Maybe we get it today. 11th Circuit, if you're listening, let's go. It's been a while. But our plaintiff, our faculty member, Adriana Novoa, she can't teach in her sociology course about Roberto Clemente, about the history of racism in baseball, about the Negro Leagues, about what it was like. She had to remove that from her curriculum. That's in our complaint. That's what you're losing. You're getting the chill, and folks are saying, you know what, I better not. I better keep my mouth shut. So to your point about censorship, yeah, I do think this overarching federal pressure, whether it's the deal we're cutting with CBS or the pressure we're bringing to bear on private institutions like Harvard, or, again, snatching students off the street for writing an op-ed about what's going on in Gaza, the chill is real. And we know from the First Amendment case law that the chill is effectively censorship.
And my quick follow-up for you, Will, is this. Does it make your job harder when they just settle versus there's no legal precedent here? They're settling the cases. Does it make your job harder?
It makes my job a lot harder. I'm on the phone with the head of the American Association of Universities, the American Association of Universities and Colleges. And when one domino falls, the rest of them think, I don't know what I can do. If Columbia can't stand up, what hope do the rest of us have?
And a lot of folks bringing up the A word, authoritarianism. I want to read this comment from Michael. It says, the fact that you're not using the word authoritarian already tells us the WHYY is bending the knee. If not, call these actions out and what the admin is doing by name. These are subjects for debate, not a king's blackmail. Although I'll note, Michael, we already lost our money, so I don't know. I don't know why we're bending anything. But so you clearly think, Will, there is a slippery slope toward authoritarianism.
Sure.
The universities clearly think this is a storm and it will pass. Why are you right and they're wrong?
Look at Hungary. Look what happens in other countries where you have an authoritarian strongman. You go after the media. You go after education. You make everybody else scared. You give private industry its side deals. And then next thing you know, there's nobody left. What about going after law firms? I mean, we're 20 minutes in? We haven't even talked about the attacks on law firms. It is a systematic attack to make dissenting extremely dangerous and extremely painful. Add in, you know, billions of dollars for secret police. Look out. You know,
Can I get you in dialogue, though, with something that Professor Lingle said earlier, which is that sort of she was pushing back on this idea that there is too much of sort of like a liberal hive mind on campus, that sort of the statistics that we see are an outgrowth of just liberal arts teaching. Do you agree with that, or do you think there was a problem here that needed to be addressed?
I think that everybody is better when you hear different viewpoints. I believe, as a First Amendment attorney, as a civil libertarian, I believe that person who only knows their own case knows half of that, right? So I want to be challenged. And I do think that for too long, universities, and I say this as a son of a university professor, a poet, I do think that universities too often are just one type of thinking. I think that universities, again, I mentioned Harvard, that can begin to embrace more viewpoints and bring them in, that's all to the good. I think you have better discussions that way. And I think the professor agrees with me. So I do think universities have some work to do to show their value. Right now, I wish universities would stand up and make the affirmative case. Here's why the social sciences are important. Here's why attacking, you know, a campus because you think it's too woke. Here's why it's going to result in your mother not being able to get the cancer treatment she needs. Make the comprehensive case about what universities provide for society. It's not just turning out woke students. That's a caricature. Yeah. That's not reality.
Yeah, I want to bring in a caller before we go to break. We have Joan from Rittenhouse Square on the line. Joan, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
So my comment is that I'm sick about Penn capitulating to the Trump administration. And the reason that I am is that educational institutions are pillars of society, one of the pillars. And when pillars of society capitulate to people like Trump and his authoritarian administration, which we are on the verge of becoming an authoritarian nation, they encourage it and make it easier for him to be an authoritarian.
Well, that's Joan from Rittenhouse Square. Thanks so much for the call, Joan. We've got a lot more to talk about on this topic, but we do have to say goodbye to you, Jessa Lingle, Associate Professor at Penn and Director of the Program in Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Will, stay right there. Will Creeley is going to stay with us. Will's from FIRE. And we have a voice from a conservative-leaning institution on the other side of this break. Of course, keep your questions and comments coming. What do you think about schools like Penn striking deals with the Trump administration? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment in the chat. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. If you are just joining us, we've been talking this hour about Penn and Columbia making concessions to the Trump administration to unfreeze federal funding.
Earlier, you heard from a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, an institution that just recently got funding reinstated after making policy changes about transgender athletes. We've also heard from Will Creeley, legal director of FIRE. Will is still with us. And we're now also joined by Jay Green, senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Jay, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me on.
And of course, listeners, viewers, we still want to hear from you. What do you think about schools like Penn striking deals with the Trump administration? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment in the chat.
And I want to read this comment from Aaliyah, who says, "We know that these institutions are, for the most part, elitist training grounds that determine haves and have-nots. Best for communities to start supporting homeschooling, entrepreneurship, etc." And so, Jay, we wanted to start this part of the conversation with you. I mean, conservatives have long accused colleges of being ideological echo chambers. I want you to sort of lay out the argument for why the Trump administration's approach to universities, that is withholding funding unless there are policy changes. Why do you think this is the correct approach?
So the thing that I support is the enforcement of civil rights legislation. And in both the case of the Columbia and Penn settlements, there were accusations of violations of civil rights. And the universities decided to settle on those accusations because they were guilty of those violations. And I think we should all agree that it's very important to uphold civil rights. And I'm a little surprised that to hear from civil libertarians that that is not important. What I heard a lot in the show leading up to now sounded like ghost stories, scary things with assumptions of things that might happen or have happened that actually haven't happened. So I'd just like to hear what exactly in the settlements that Columbia and Penn struck violated the First Amendment.
Will, I'll let you take that.
Yeah, let me start. As a civil libertarian, one of the civil liberties I value is due process, and I believe that the law says what it says. So when Title VI and its implementing regulations require the federal government to, first of all, seek voluntary compliance, second of all, afford the university notice and a hearing, finally, to require Congress to weigh in, none of those steps was followed by the Trump administration. Again, I'm old enough to remember leading a fight against the Obama administration's redefinition of sexual harassment. And I did that with the support of many conservatives because at that time they understood that the process protects us against federal government overreach, exactly the kind of overreach that's at issue here. If Columbia failed to respond appropriately to anti-Semitism on campus, and they might have, then Title VI provides the process through which federal funding can be revoked. We did not follow that process. You cannot separate the settlement from the process that preceded it.
Yeah, and I think one of the arguments, Jay, is that this will unleash chaos, that the next administration could be left-leaning and could say, you know what, we don't think School X has responded appropriately to sexual assault on campus. And rather than go through a process of trying to prove that and adjudicate that, we will simply freeze their funding day one and make them come to our terms. I mean, is that not a concern for you?
So first, my question was First Amendment of violations, because I heard Will describe during the first part of this show that the Trump administration was violating the First Amendment with these agreements at Penn and Columbia. And I haven't heard any examples of that. Now, as to the due process concerns, First, the Trump administration paused funding, did not eliminate funding. And there's a question as to whether they could do that as they then begin the process required by the civil rights legislation. And if Penn and Columbia believed that the correct process was not being filed, they could have followed. They could have pursued legal action and prevailed, and perhaps Harvard will. So the process matters, but so does the substance here. And I heard a lot of ghost stories earlier in the show about speech being suppressed, and I just don't understand how it is that enforcing civil rights law, both Title VI and Title IX, leads to the suppression of free speech.
Well, go ahead. So I think what Jay was saying is that mm-hmm. what were the actual sort of violations here? Not the future potential violations, sure. But the violations.
Let me be clear. Last year, the Supreme Court decided a case called National Rifle Association v. Vullo, and that involved a New York State official telling insurance companies they could not associate with the NRA because of its political viewpoints. It's called jawboning. It's indirect censorship. The Supreme Court reaffirmed it violates the First Amendment. That is exactly what the Trump administration has done here. They have said, hey, Columbia, and putting aside the semantic choice to call it a pause instead of a revocation, the administration trumpeted it as a revocation. They said, hey, Columbia, we've frozen all this funding. You will accede to this list of demands. They sent a demand letter. And if you do not, billions more funding will be on the line. That violates the First Amendment. That's jawboning. Again, some of the substance of those demands. Adopt this expansive definition of anti-Semitism, which raises clear First Amendment problems. It involves suppression of criticism of the state of Israel. The federal government cannot tell a private institution what rules it must have regarding speech and what protected speech must be punished at that university. The federal government also told Columbia that the Department of Middle East Studies had to be under academic receivership. Again, that is the federal government dictating to a private university what can be taught and who can teach it. Flies directly in the face of academic freedom, as the Supreme Court has upheld 70 years. That's not a ghost story. That's reality. We can go back and look at that demand letter, and we can see what Columbia agreed to this past week.
And Jay, did you want
to... Did they agree to those things? Let's talk about the agreements.
They have already taken action in response to the threat. When a mobster has a gun at your head and says, make these changes, you make those changes. That's exactly what Columbia did. Again, violates the First Amendment. In the agreement, Columbia now must require incoming students to commit to the values of the university. Some of those values I like free speech and open inquiry. I fight for those values every day, but I do it in accordance with the rule of law. They've also required students to commit to, quote unquote, equality and respect. Let me tell you, when the federal government gets to define what respect means, I get nervous because I'm a civil libertarian.
Yeah, I want to bring in a caller. We have Howard from Mount Laurel on the line. Howard, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I guess it's a comment and then a question. I'll be as brief as I can. To me, the initial problem at Penn was anti-Semitism, as went on at Harvard and MIT as well. And if let be alone those presidents of those universities would have tried to play the context role. And then it got worse and worse, and they weren't really adhering to Article 6. So I was extremely upset at that time when the encampment took place and all the tents happened to be the same make. There was backing, tremendous backing. Then Trump, and when he started to, act as Trump and only Trump can do, or will do, I should say, mm-hmm. He crossed the red line. He got into vetting. He got into the ideology. These are things that you just can't do. That's authoritarian, as has been mentioned.
Yeah.
So to me, they lost in the sea of all these other things is the real problem that started with Penn, because you're doing Penn and Columbia. And he is a deal maker. That's it. That's how he lives. That's how he enjoys mm-hmm. life. Yeah. And that's how he, yeah. Yeah.
And that's...
So he...
Yeah, I understand, Howard. Yeah. I think we have to move this along, yeah, but thank you so much for the call.
And I want to sort of get to what I think Howard was trying to get to here, Jay. And a lot of people have said, you know what, the Trump administration started this query against these elite universities with the idea of fighting for civil rights, for anti-Semitism on campus. But that was just a ruse to sort of get within these universities and really exert power and to do other things, to get under the hood and to coerce them into changing other policies. What do you say in response to that?
Well, let's look at what the agreements actually contain. So the agreement that Penn struck was regarding whether biological males or people born as male could compete in women's divisions of college athletics and be in private spaces that were exclusive for women, like changing rooms, bathrooms. And that was the agreement that was struck. Now, I don't know how agreeing to that would be a civil rights capitulation or any of the other scary things that we heard about. We, you know, could debate whether we think that that is what Title IX, in fact, requires. But I think it's a very reasonable interpretation of Title IX that it was meant to protect women having equal access to sports, and when biological males then would take spots on those teams from biological females and take victories from biological females and subject biological females to having to be in the same private spaces, the same locker rooms as biological males, that would be a violation of Title IX. And I think the university agreed that they had violated Title IX, which is why they reached that settlement. There's no scary change of curriculum or loss of academic freedom or free speech violation involved in that. So everything we just heard was a bunch of ghost stories.
Well, let me ask
you
this.
Instead, what we have is a particular dispute about Title IX. Now, at Columbia, the settlement
was... Can we stick
was...
on Penn for a second, though? Because I...
Sure.
Just because we're a Philly show.
So,
All along, before we got to this place of them coming to an agreement, one of the arguments you heard from the folks that were, you know, encouraging Penn to push back is that Penn complied with the NCAA's rules at that time, and this seems to set up a paradigm where a school could comply with the rules as they are at a given time. Those rules could change down the road and they could be punished retroactively for complying with the rules as they were. They could say, you were complying with the rules, but those rules, by the way, compelled you to violate Title IX. I mean,
right.
That seems like an important...
The rule that matters
like a,
is Title IX there. Not,
but that seems
not
like a Pandora's... Is that not a Pandora's box, Jay? To say, like, you followed the rule, but by the way, we have now decided that rule was wrong. We've changed the rule and punished you for following the rule at the time.
So the rule's not changed. Title IX is the same.
But the NCAA is the sanctioning body of sports, right? And they seem to... My understanding is they were saying that this is the proper procedure at that time.
So NCAA is a private association of college athletics. It's not the federal government telling you what Title IX requires. And so, again, I said we could have a dispute about what the correct settlement of the Title IX dispute should be, but none of it involved infringing upon academic freedom, free speech violations, checking people's syllabi, chilling things on campus. All of those were ghost stories that seemed to be a product of some sort of Trump derangement syndrome. And again, people cannot like Trump, but we don't have to make the paranoia that we were talking about here seems to be fostered by people making up stories about all of the infringements that are occurring that did not occur. This was a particular dispute over whether biological males would compete in female athletics in college and be in their private spaces or not. That's what the Penn settlement was about.
Well, I wanted to get your response to that because, as Jay points out, right, there's been no, like, court ruling on whether that, I guess, rule was a violation of Title IX or not. I guess it's up to anyone's interpretation at this point. What does the Penn example tell you?
It tells me that there is partisan pressure brought to bear on private institutions to walk the federal government's preferred line, even if at the time you were following the rules that everybody else was following. Look out, because here comes the federal government. Look, I have defended conservative students and faculty for my entire career. I do think it's important to have conservative voices on campus. I've defended those voices. I just can't recognize conservatives now who are very comfortable with the idea of using the government for their preferred partisan ends. It just, I just can't get around it. These are the same folks who 5 years ago said we are champions of free speech on campus. And now they're saying there are certain things you cannot talk about on campus. It just does
and
not add
how
up.
Is the Title IX settlement a free speech violation?
Because, sir, the willingness to use federal anti-discrimination law as a cudgel at Penn, at most particularly Harvard, Columbia, other universities are now under investigation to dictate terms of acceptable discourse per the federal government's mandates. And all I have to do is say, folks, go to our website, thefire.org, thefire.org. You will see our good faith, nonpartisan approach for years and years. I've been defended conservatives for my whole damn career. And I'm happy to show you the equal abuses in the last year of liberal speakers being shut down on campus. That is a real First Amendment problem, and it makes me very nervous about the future of our country.
Let me bring in, no, I don't think we have time for the caller.
Yeah,
you know, we're coming
it?
Up against,
yeah.
But Skain on YouTube says, there are conservative colleges and universities. I don't see the government forcing liberal ideas into, say, West Point. This isn't viewpoint diversity. It's forcing one viewpoint on all spaces. I do think we have to leave it there. I know we could talk a lot more about this, but I want to thank both of you for your time today. Will Creeley is the legal director of FIRE. Jay Green is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Appreciate you both coming on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Yes, and we're sorry we couldn't get to Amber and Rich, who were holding on the line. We would have loved to hear your comments today. Thank you to everybody who emailed in, and thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer. Thanks to Diana Martinez and Adam Stanishevsky, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Thank you so much for joining us.